This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on January 20th, 2011. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Thank you. We're going to try this again. My apologies to the Commission Secretary for attempting to start a meeting without her presence, which would not follow our own rules. So I apologize for that. Again, I will call to order the meeting for January 20th. We have been working on a couple of agenda items in an attempt to try to reach some consensus, and I think we have, so that's the good news. We'll get started with the first item on our agenda is the correction and approval of minutes. Is there a motion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move to approve agenda document number 11-01, minutes for the open session held on December 16th, 2010.
Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion passes 6-0. The next three items on our agenda are a couple of audit reports that the Commission has actually taken final votes on, and at this stage we are preparing the final report of the Commission. And just as a little bit of background, in July we adopted a new directive to inform the construction of these reports. And so these are some of the first that will be operating under that directive. As I mentioned, the reason for our late delay was in terms of trying to reach some consensus on some of these documents. For purposes of today, I'm going to hold over the second item on the agenda, the proposed final audit report on the Tennessee Democratic Party, A0707, and the proposed final audit report on the Washington State Democratic Central Committee, OA5-28, because we are going to work on the third item on the agenda, which is the proposed final audit report on the Tennessee Republican Party federal election account, A0705. And if we can reach some agreement with respect to that, it will help us inform the discussion and the conclusion with respect to the other two. Before we move on to that discussion, are there any late submitted documents?
Yes, if I may, we have a few late submitted documents to read into the record. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda documents 10-76, 10-76A, 10-76B, 10-75, 10-75A, 10-75B, 10-74, 10-74A, and agenda document numbers 11-02 and 11-02A.
Without objection, those will be before the Commission. Moving on to item number 3, the Tennessee Republican Party federal election account. Do we have a presentation by the Audit Division, or shall we move immediately to drafts?
I think we should move immediately to drafts.
Thank you, Mr. Stoltz. We'll do so. There are a couple of new agenda items, agenda documents, some newer than others. There is a blue draft that was made blue pursuant to our December 2nd agenda. That was the original report circulated by the Audit Division. There was a second document made blue earlier this morning, which represented a proposal, and there is a red line that is some comments to the proposal that was on the table. So those are the documents that we have. Is there any discussion or any motions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're all so shy this morning.
Me too.
I think partly because the draft of this was circulated. The latest draft was, well, not the latest draft. The second to latest draft was circulated at 9:30 last night, and then we had revisions that were worked out, you know, virtually as we were walking in the door of this meeting. And I can support the latest round of revisions, but I just want to be clear on what we're doing here, because last year we spent months negotiating a new directive on how we were going to handle audits. And at the time, there were templates, that word was used, prepared, based on audit reports that we had in front of us that were supposed to be the model going forward. And then no sooner did we try and actually apply this that we found out that, no, those weren't the templates. We need new templates. We need to restructure them. The directive didn't capture what we wanted. The templates didn't capture what we wanted. Most of the changes appear to me to be adding subheadings and numbered paragraphs. And I'm not entirely clear that the little numbers actually make anything any clearer. If you want to have more subheadings and you want to have numbers, that's okay with me. I don't know that it was worth holding things up for another month so we could put in numbered paragraphs and extra subheadings. But I guess what I want to know is, are we done now? Is this really going to be the template going forward? Or is the next time we get an audit report, are we going to then hear again, oh, no, we don't like the way this is structured. We need to make more changes. Because we have to get our work done. These audit reports have been sitting around. One of these three audits, not one that we're actually going to vote on today, we had the hearing in 2009. And we have been sitting on these things for quite a long time. These committees deserve some closure on these issues. So my question to my colleagues is, are we done now?
Commissioner McGann.
Time will tell. The process with audits has been a long and painful process. And hopefully this is a culmination of what's been a lot of work by a lot of people. When I joined the commission, to those who I dealt with before I joined the commission, the audit process was not one that was well seen as particularly open and fair. Since then, the commission has done quite a bit to change that. We've put in a procedure where you can brief your issues directly with the commission. You can appear before the commission. We had a situation that caused me to essentially apologize from the dais to a group that was audited at the AFL-CIO. They audited on a theory that the commission had approved 30 years before, but nonetheless, they had to endure the burdens of an audit. That was really the genesis of the latest wave of changes. The issue here today with these audits and why these took so long is my sense was we had to get it right going forward, because if we get it right now, it will take care of itself in the future and we won't have to keep revisiting it. And by it, I mean the ability of the public to see what happened in an audit. The audit reports years ago tended to be longer and more detailed. Over the years, they've gotten shorter and more in what I call audit speak. And it really is no one's fault. I think it just creeped over time. And it's consistent with what the agency has done in a number of matters, where when there's not agreement among the six-headed beast that is the commission, it gets glossed over by avoiding the issue or fuzzy language. These audits, at least in hopefully in the future, at least the one that's on the table today, I think stretches out the analysis a little bit more, and I think we're pushing back toward a little bit more of a narrative. The problem with the narrative I discovered after the directive, which doesn't really speak to what we're doing here today, what the directive spoke to was making clear that the audit report is the commission's report. It's not some other branch of the government called the audit division. It's actually the FEC is one body, and it's the commission's audit report. That's what the directive, I think, was designed to do. But the devil then became in the details And after these audits, after we voted certain ways, the audit staff took another crack at drafting them. And some of the language was still confusing because of the structure of the document. And what became tough for me is to vote for a document to be construed as me adopting a position that I did not hold. And I know several of my colleagues had the same concern. So this latest round of changes, which I've been pushing for quite some time, was structural. And you're right, it is point headings. But the idea is that the audit reports are now more clear what is the portion that is what the auditors thought, their recommendation, what the respondent or the committee or whatever we call it, an audit, the person being audited thought, and then what the commission actually did. Other audit reports have tended to get munched together because in the narrative of the history of the audit, it was less than clear, and it's sometimes absolutely baffling as to whether that was a position of the auditors that was being articulated or a position of the commission. Hopefully, we have gotten past that, and we can now make clear which is which. I think it's important for the public to see what the auditors did and did not do. I did not think that when I joined the commission. I've been persuaded by others that that's an important consideration, and I think it does give the public an opportunity to see what happened. It also does maintain some independence of the auditors so that they're able to perform their function as auditors. Occasionally, though, auditors are forced in the position of playing lawyer where actually legal questions arise, and that's really where the tension is because it's ultimately the commission who has the final word on the construction of the act and its own regulations, not the audit staff. And this brings back the point of we need to separate what the auditors did versus what the commission did, and now we've done that. We did it through a directive. We're doing this through this model, and that's really the intent. Yes, it's taken a long time, but haste makes waste, and I'd rather measure twice and cut once, and that's the only two cliches I'll use in connection with audit reports today. I'll save the rest for later in the meeting. So this was not an intentional slow roll or anything designed to merely let the perfect be the enemy of the good enough. I think it was important to get this right because we've spent too much time on audit reports. The commission over the years has spent too much time on audits, and it's the same issue time and time again. Years ago, 10 years ago, when Daryl Wold was on the commission, he developed the idea that you would vote to accept an audit report. That was considered not adopting the finding. That made no sense to the public over time because that distinction had sort of never really been codified or written down. So the point today is to make clear, at least for me and I know several of my colleagues, is the section where the commission did the action, that's the part that really I think is the operative approach going forward. Old audits, very tough to tell what was the view of the audit and what was the view of the commission. Also tough to know why commissioners may have rejected a finding or modified a finding. So really what this is, sure, it's a writing job, it's point headings, but I think it's going to go a long way to clarity for the public. The other phenomena of audits is because we have auditors who have been here a long time with a tremendous amount of institutional knowledge, going way back, even frankly, before the FEC was established by Congress. We like to say Joe Stultz, the head of audit, was at the FEC before there was an FEC. At times, the commission has relied on that institutional knowledge. I think it needs to be memorialized more in audit reports, and I think that's something that we're now doing. I want to thank my colleagues for indulging me in this quest to bring some clarity and some transparency to the audit process. I know it wasn't easy. Much of what I was doing early on made no sense to many people. Over time, it started to make sense, and I think in the future, it'll make even more sense, and ultimately, it'll make sense to the public who reads these and those who have to live under the regulations imposed by the government on their political activities. So with that, I yield back, and I thank the chair for the opportunity to express my views. I know Commissioner Peterson has some substantive comments, but I just wanted to address the Commissioner Weintraub's comments on why it took so long and what we're actually doing here. What we're doing here is trying to do a better job at informing the public as to what the commission has actually done.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with what Commissioner McGann just said, and I think in answer to Commissioner Weintraub's question, I mean, it certainly is not my aim and my goal to have the Commission rewrite these extensively every time every time something comes up for our consideration. I think that the goal has been to provide a model, and sometimes providing templates is easy in theory, but when the actual details get put into those templates, it took a little bit of working out, but I think that this exercise, though frustrating and I think lengthier than I think any of us would have liked it to be, hopefully we've worked out many of the kinks so that these can be disposed of in a much more efficient manner. A couple of clarifications I want to make sure on the record. The audit that we'll be voting on today isn't the only audit that we've been working on over the last month or so. So it's not that we spent a month just adding headings and renumbering things. There have been a number of other audits, especially one in particular that has a finding that has a number of issues within it. And one of our goals was to try to unpack those issues in a way that provided a little bit more clarity as to what the Commission decided and what the legal standards were for each of those issues. And that's one that's being held over, and hopefully we can reach a quick resolution on that. But there have been a number of audits that we've been working on simultaneously. But I think that I appreciate my colleagues. Again, this was kind of a late-breaking effort to try to get at least some of this off the table at this particular meeting. And we've been the base document is agenda document number 10-75-A. And we have some, I guess, at-the-table edits that will be proposed. I don't know if we would like to address those now. I think they look fine, and I appreciate the chair for the response to the edits that we submitted. The only change that I would make is on pages. This is I'm going to be referring pages to a document that isn't blue, but this is in the additional issues section. First on page 13 and then on page 16. Currently, in the blue document, it's the beginning sentence of the third paragraph, talking about in light of the clarity regarding the amount of volunteer involvement needed to qualify for the volunteer materials exception, the Commission did not approve the committee, the audit staff's recommended finding by the required four votes in the draft that was given to us by the chair. That introductory phrase is deleted. I would ask that we include that phrase back in. I think it provides a little more understanding about why the Commission did what it did. I think it is accurate that there is the issue of the clarity of the standard for what will be sufficient volunteer involvement to qualify for the volunteer materials exception has been one that has been a difficult one that many commissions over many years have been grappling with. And so with that small change, I can otherwise support all the edits that were forwarded to us by the chair. Thank you.
Thank you. And I do want to thank Commissioner Peterson. While he was chair, he did try to put these on the agenda a number of times, and this has been something that we've been working on. And one of the reasons I put them on this agenda is because these reports have been pending before the Commission for quite some time, and sometimes it is a deadline that does force us to actually get on paper particular views. So the goal would be to use this as a template. I hear from my colleagues that is the goal. So we will take people at their word that this is the format that we're going to use going forward, and we'll ask the auditors if we can achieve consensus on this to conform the other documents on the agenda to that. Any further discussion or motions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to be clear that I think, as I said, I'm willing to go along with them. I don't think we've added any great clarity to the document in these last-minute edits. I think it is it is just as clear or unclear as it was before. I am happy to be in a position where we can give some direction to the staff and turn it back to them to do the work. It's my experience that when we give clear directions to the staff, they follow them pretty well. You know, the problem is when we give muddled directions to the staff, then it's harder to figure out what exactly their marching orders are. And I also wanted to say that, you know, we vote on things. We either adopt the conclusions or don't adopt the conclusions, accept recommendations or not, and the commission has been doing that for as long as it's been in existence. But the commission is more than six individuals who get to sit at the dais make speeches here. The commission is a government agency comprised of roughly 350 hardworking individuals, and I think that we need to be, I want to be really clear that I don't think we're the only people that count. I don't think we ought to engage in rewriting things just because we can, just for the sake of rewriting it. It's, you know, we get the final say, and we get to be the ones who adopt the document at the end of the day, and we're responsible for it. But from my perspective, the agency cannot survive, can't function on the work of six people, even six people and their very industrious executive assistants and counsel. Most of the work in this agency always has, always will be done by the people who work below the ninth floor. And I'm very appreciative of that work. And I think the, you know, drawing these distinctions between the auditors and the commission, as if the auditors are not part of the commission, sets up a false dichotomy, and I'm not in favor of doing that.
Commissioner Walther.
I can go along with the template that we're using, we're going to adopt today. I'm not critical of the ones we've used in the past. I think the main point, of course, as Commissioner McGann says, is we want to make sure that it's clearly understood what happened, who did what, how response was given to recommendations made by the audit. The one thing that has concerned me in the process is a little bit of an over attempt to rewrite this. And my concern is I don't want to see the independence of the audit division eroded in any respect. I think one of the most important things about the audit is that the auditors get to do their best professional job, and we can comment on it, but I don't think we should supersede it. And so I think the template's fine. This particular draft, the changes that are made, I can live with except for one I'll have to mention. And then other than that, I think if we go forward for a while and let's see what happens. We did I think, do a lot of work last year, and I thought I got the job done, and here we're doing it again. But I can't be critical of it because there seems to be a view that you know, we can reach a conclusion on something that will go forward without further amendment. I would like to ask Mr. Stoltz if there's anything in this audit or are you comfortable with the format that we're looking at today? Do you have any thoughts on where to go? I mean, it's not been the format that's always been used by your office. And I know that you have to, you know, sometimes just suck it up and go with what the commission does, but this is what you do day in and day out. So we really, I think, need to know how you see it.
Formats evolve over time. And, you know, if the consensus is that this is easier to follow and clear, that's fine. I have no objection to putting it in this format. It's really doesn't make a lot of difference to me one way or the other, as long as we can get things. If this is what we want to do, then great, that's what we'll do.
The one area that I asked to be amended was to delete the commission conclusion on the draft 1075A, and so the draft 1075B makes some other changes that the commissioner Commissioner Peterson mentioned, but at the very end it says, in lack of clarity regarding the amount of volunteer involvement needed to qualify for the exemption, the volunteer exemption. We did this before, and I objected, and I didn't vote for this coming out of audit for the same reason, because I think it sends a message that, in our view, the law is not clear enough to enforce. And that's basically the way we've kind of punted on this. And I think the volunteer exemption is there for a reason, and we should try and exercise our best commission judgment to try and define what that is under the facts that are before us. Sometimes we deadlock, but just to say, well, there's a lack of clarity means we don't even have to talk about it anymore. So I'm concerned about that, and I'll vote against it, but only for that reason, just to maintain the consistency with my previous position on it.
Any further discussion? Vice Chair Hunter.
Sure. I'd like to move adoption of Agenda Document 10-75B with the change described by Commissioner Peterson at the bottom of page 13, restoring the language on the last two lines of page 13. Sorry, and that's also on page 16, thank you, and page 3. The question before the commission is the motion to approve the final audit report for the Tennessee Republican Party federal election account as reflected in 10-75B with the changes described by Vice Chair Hunter on page 3, page 13, and page 16. Is there any discussion on that motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
The motion carries 5-1, with Commissioner Weintraub, Commissioner Peterson, Commissioner McGann, Vice Chair Hunter, and myself voting in favor, Commissioner Walther voting against. Thank you very much. The next item on our agenda is a notice of proposed rulemaking governing independent expenditures and electioneering communications by corporations and labor organizations. And as you'll see from the shifting of people in the room, we have several members of the Office of General Counsel available to answer questions today, including Rosie Smith, Robert Knopp, Cheryl Hemsley, Phil Olea, Joanna Waldreicher, and Esther Hayden, who will start us off with a presentation. Ms. Hayden, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Bowerly, and good morning, Commissioners. The alternative draft notices of proposed rulemaking in Agenda Documents 11-02 and 11-02A propose changes to the Commission's rules regarding the use of corporate and labor organization treasury funds to make expenditures, independent expenditures, and electioneering communications. The proposed changes are in response to the decision of the Supreme Court in Citizens United, which found that the prohibition on corporate independent expenditures and electioneering communications in 2 U.S.C. 441B violates the First Amendment. The proposals in both drafts include removing the prohibitions on the financing of expenditures, independent expenditures, and electioneering communications by corporations and labor organizations, removing the qualified nonprofit corporation exception, removing the functional equivalent of express advocacy test at 11 CFR 114.15, adding a new regulation that would explicitly state that corporations and labor organizations may make independent expenditures and electioneering communications, and making changes to regulations in 11 CFR Part 114 concerning communications by corporations and labor organizations to the restricted class and to the general public. Draft A also includes proposed changes to the reporting regulations at 11 CFR 104.20 and 109.10, and the regulation prohibiting participation by foreign nationals in the U.S. electoral process. Several of the proposals in both drafts include alternative proposals. If the Commission approves either Draft A or Draft B of the NPRM, the Office of General Counsel seeks authority to make technical and conforming changes to that draft and will submit the draft with any technical and conforming changes for publication in the Federal Register. Thank you, and I would be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Hayden. Let me begin briefly by explaining why this is on the agenda today. A year ago tomorrow, the Supreme Court announced its decision in the Citizens United case, which had some very serious implications for the FICA and the Commission regulations implementing that act. Under leadership of then-Chairman Peterson, the Commission very quickly put out a statement outlining the immediate effect of the decision with respect to the Commission's enforcement, litigation, and rulemaking docket, as well as providing some basic guidance to corporations and labor organizations that intended to finance independent expenditures or electioneering communications in accordance with the Supreme Court's decision. That was a very good start. Since then, we have been working hard to complete one of the major steps outlined in that statement, namely initiating a rulemaking. We were very close to an NPRM that had unanimous or at least majority support later last calendar year, but unfortunately we're unable to finalize that in a way that worked for all concerned. But the work continues. As you see, there are two drafts today, and I think it is important that we begin to move this process forward in a manner that allows the public to understand the issues underlying some of the existing disagreements. A year after the decision, I think we owe as much to those who are looking for some guidance on these subjects. In my view, it's the Commission's job not only to ask which regulations must be repealed as a result of the Supreme Court's decision, but also to ask whether our existing rules must be revised to ensure that they continue to serve their original purpose in light of the repeal of the prohibition on corporate expenditures. I want to emphasize that the purpose of an NPRM is to ask questions, propose options, and gather comments from the public to guide the Commission in crafting a rule. There's no obligation in an NPRM, and that's why I think it's important and appropriate to ask questions about a number of different topics and options. Voting for any of these particular questions in an NPRM does in no way commits a commissioner to any final outcome. We know there are a lot of ideas and comments circulating about these issues. There have been dozens of panel discussions held by universities and public interest groups. In fact, there are several panel discussions later today on the court's decision on the Hill. Given the interest and the ready ideas, I remain hopeful that at the end of the day, we can find a way to hear them in a rulemaking process. With that, I'd like to open the floor to commissioners with comments or questions for the General Counsel staff on the drafts. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here today to talk about disclosure, which I think is one of the key issues in the Citizens United case. We have two draft NPRMs that are in front of us today. One of them, and there's a lot of similarities between them, and that's not really surprising because both of them are the product of extensive discussions that went on throughout last year. The draft that, I guess it's draft A, that was put forward by the chair and Commissioner Walther and myself contains many additions, suggestions, amendments that were suggested by our Republican colleagues over the course of last year. The big difference between the two drafts, you know, for those of you who really don't want to spend your day reading through every page of both drafts, let me give you the highlights. The big difference between the two drafts is that draft A contains sections posing questions about disclosure and foreign nationals, and draft B doesn't. And personally, I just don't think that we can adequately address the court's ruling and the ramifications for our law without addressing those two important topics. Promoting transparency in American elections is central to the Commission's mission, and this transparency in turn is essential to the success of this, the world's oldest democracy. We don't believe in doing things in secret. That's why we're here at the table today. We went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and even though we didn't have one consensus document that everyone was ready to support, some of us felt that after a year, we really owed the public the obligation of having at least a public discussion of what the issues were and how people felt about them. On a personal level, I have been working to promote openness and transparency in our political system for over 20 years. At the Ethics Committee, in private practice, here at the Commission, members' personal financial disclosures, lobbying disclosures, campaign finance disclosure, obviously. One of the reasons I was so honored to have the opportunity to serve here at the Commission is because transparency in politics and transparency in government has been an issue that I have been committed to and advocating for 20 years, and it is central to the mission of this agency and integral to the mission of this agency. So I'm not somebody who recently jumped on the bandwagon, who read an article about somebody else doing something on disclosure and said, wow, that's a good idea. I think I'll jump on that issue. That looks pretty cool. I've been doing this for 20 years. I've got street cred on this. And for me, it is just an incredibly important aspect of this decision. It's key to the issue, to the decision. It was the seminal issue in the decision. And you don't have to take my word on it. You can look at Citizens United, their jurisdictional statement to the Supreme Court. The argument section, I think, goes on for about 13 pages, 9 of which concern disclosure issues. Did the court subsequently expand the scope of what they wanted to do in that decision? Obviously, they did. And certainly our draft addresses many of the issues, most of them that we could think of, that that are raised by the entire decision. But while the court expanded the scope of the decision, it didn't shrink it. It didn't take out the disclosure elements. The constitutionality of the disclosure portions of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, of the disclosure provisions and the electioneering communications provisions, were approved facially by 8 members of the Supreme Court in the McConnell decision and approved on an as-applied challenge by 8 members of the Supreme Court in the Citizens United decision. The issue was squarely put before the court and decided by the court. Sorry. I have too fat a notebook. In fact, in the got the wrong piece. Oh, sorry. In the Citizens United decision, the court quoted the McConnell decision on disclosure. The court said there was evidence in the record that independent groups, and evidence before the McConnell court, that independent groups were running election-related advertisements while hiding behind dubious and misleading names. The court therefore upheld BCRA Section 2001 and 311. On the ground that they would help citizens make informed choices in the political marketplace. And I think it is just critically important that we ensure that we are continuing to maintain that transparency in the political marketplace, that we are adequately enforcing the law that was passed by Congress and approved, held constitutional twice by 8 members of the Supreme Court. So I said, really, I think in our very first discussion that we ever had internally about this decision, that for me, disclosure had to be front and center in whatever document we put out. And I could not see a way to approving a notice of proposed rulemaking that didn't address the disclosure issues in Citizens United. And I have maintained that position consistently for the last year. And I maintain it to this day, and that's why the disclosure issues are, we think, fully discussed in Draft A. But as I have repeatedly offered my colleagues, if you have other thoughts on disclosure, if you have other ideas that you would like to put forward for comment, we are happy to entertain them. What I personally am not happy to entertain is the notion that we're just going to ignore what the Supreme Court said on disclosure. We're going to just pretend those pages of the opinion aren't there, and we are not interested in hearing from any member of the public on any aspect of the disclosure ramifications of the decision. Thank you.
Further discussion? Commissioner Walther.
I'm not sure exactly where you want to go with it because we're talking only about A right now, but There's two things. I agree with the Commissioner Weintraub totally on the importance of transparency. That's why we're here. Watergate's here to a large degree because some reporters followed the money. And the only way they could follow the money to do it the way you've all read about and know about. Now, hopefully, a lot more of the money can be followed on the Internet quickly, be examined by millions of people who want to, and give input, and it substantially reduces the chance of undue influence by money as long as it's disclosed. And regardless of our views on Citizens United, we are all in unanimous agreement that disclosure is one of the most important aspects of a successful democracy. With respect to our agency and where we should go now, since the days of the beginning of the agency back in 1975, corporations are now only for the first time permitted to spend their treasury profits on political speech, that is, on communications that expressly advocate the election or defeat of a federal candidate. In the aftermath of Watergate, because of the undue influence money had on elections, Congress enacted the Federal Election Campaign Act that prohibited corporations from spending their profits to influence elections. The Supreme Court's now told us that corporations are entitled to the same First Amendment free speech rights as any other American citizen, and the Supreme Court decision is now the law of the land. But our analysis can't only be stopped now. It isn't only about whether corporations can spend their profits on political speech. It is also by providing American public, the electorate, with meaningful and timely information about who is spending money on political speech and about how much is being spent. The concern I have here is that the draft that we propose really covers the disclosure issues and the issues with respect to First Amendment, with respect to foreign investment, that we've never had to look at before. And if we don't look at it now, then it won't ever be looked at, and there will be a complete void in our regulatory scheme simply because of the enactment of the statute. We've never had to look at disclosure for corporations that use their own money for independent speech. So for us to now say we're not going to do it now, I think is not fulfilling our statutory duty, or to the extent there was an intent of Congress, at least for us to regulate in areas where disclosure can be regulated, I think we're missing out. I know that some of my colleagues think that because the Disclose Act was not passed, that it's further evidence that, and I know they'll hasten to correct me if I'm wrong, it's further evidence that there was no real congressional intent that we should be in the scheme, in the regulatory scheme, since they're not doing it themselves. But on the other hand, I think we have an obligation to move forward with the laws that are now in place and to provide a method by which disclosure can take place. And I think we'll get into a little more detail about it as we go along. I hope that, and I'm critical of the agency for taking this long, 1 year, to even come up with two drafts on which the public can now see how we see some of the issues. I think we're missing the boat with an NPRM, Notice of Public Rulemaking, if we don't keep in mind the only reason for that is to get public input on what our regulations we should adopt. So when we put in our text questions about this, it doesn't mean that we think that's the best way to go or the only way to go. It means that we want to raise the issue so the public can give us input to help us be better at rulemaking. And I think we've been bound up to some degree on what we think ultimately the law ought to be, and therefore the text of the rulemaking or the questions should be skewed in such a way as to elicit facts that really go in one direction or the other. And I would hope that we should reach agreement, and I would hope in the next 30 days to take these two documents and coalesce them and agree that each side who has their own slant at present can live with the questions offered and issues raised by the other. And I think if we can't do that, then we have no other alternative to ask for public input on both drafts and go from there. But if we can coalesce it, I think we should be willing to then consider, because of the mammoth aspect of the implications of Citizens United, to consider if we want to have two hearings on separate topics or segregated comments from the public. I'm open to that, but I think we need to get on with this one way or the other and get the issues before the public so we can get comment.
Any further comment or discussion? Just a point of clarification, something Commissioner Walther said made me really raise this. Both drafts are before the commission. Both drafts are before the commission at this point. So if there's further discussion on any of either of the drafts, that would be in order now. Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. Today I'm here wholeheartedly supporting removing a number of regulations from the FEC's rules. It's rare that this happens in the modern administrative state where an agency gets to actually scale back its rule book, and this is done really because of a Supreme Court case which has become all too familiar to all too many, the Citizens United decision. Recall what the issue in that case was. It was the effort of the government to ban a movie that, with all due respect to Citizens United, was not particularly good and which no one saw. They didn't see it because it wasn't available on pay-per-view. So in the privacy of one's home, one could not pay to see a movie that said bad things about a candidate for president. It was banned because of a rule the commission passed in the wake of another Supreme Court case regarding the Wisconsin Right to Life folks. They wanted to run some television ads talking about judicial nominations and wanted to urge senators not to block the filibuster and then Judge Sam Alito's nomination to the Supreme Court. The commission had said, well, those are the functional equivalents of express advocacy, and the Supreme Court said, no, they're not. In the wake of that case, the commission passed a rule, which in Citizens United was made clear was a two-part, 11-factor balancing test, certainly not the sort of clear standards that the court since Buckley, frankly, before Buckley, but certainly since Buckley, has said must govern the regulation of speech. So we're here today on what should be a happy occasion for those of us who have sought clarity in the law, less regulation, more of a focus on the core of what the Federal Election Campaign Act is designed to combat, which is corruption or its appearance. But unfortunately, it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, but from what I've read in the newspapers this week, we are at impasse, and that this removal of regs is going to be held hostage for reasons that, to me, are not appropriate. First, the difference between the two proposals is essentially the disclosure provisions, but let's talk for a minute what kind of disclosure provisions those are. Essentially, it's the Disclose Act, at least portions of the Disclose Act. We all know that did not pass Congress. Under our system of government, the legislative power is vested in Congress. Article 1 of the Constitution is first in the Constitution for a reason. It's not the job of an unelected agency to decide it knows better. Entirely consistent, though, is this mentality with those of other Beltway bureaucracies, the idea that we know best and let's not that messy thing known as democracy get in the way. When the Disclose Act went through the House and the Senate, it didn't pass. It was criticized. It was considered not without its controversy. And there was quite a bit of criticism that it was not really done in the open, and it was a rather irony that the Disclose Act was not done really with a lot of disclosure. But fortunately, all that was mooted because it did not pass. But we're here today trying to implement it through regulation. I guess the adage is that which you cannot achieve through legislation, you achieve through regulation. That, I think, is improper. We're an agency of limited jurisdiction, unlike other agencies like the EPA, who wants to regulate emission standards, and FCC and their net neutrality. We do not have such a broad grant of power to regulate an industry or administer a program, save for the presidential funding provisions, which we do, I think, administer in that way. So we do not have some roving power to fill in gaps left by Congress and the like. Instead, as Buckley and his progenies made clear, we are limited to the language of the statute. Second, the last thing we need is even more regulation. In 1980, the Code of Federal Regulations that governed politics, 11 CFR, was 138 pages long. Today it's 555 pages long. Today we have a chance to shrink that ever so slightly, but we are not going to start that start the process of shrinking it. I anticipate that's not going to happen. Hopefully I'm wrong. I oppose the other proposal in addition to the additional regulation. In my view, it does not at all contemplate the price it imposes, the burden it places by its additional regulation. In fact, it quote-unquote certifies that a quote should not be burdensome, unquote, and quote costs would not be very great. It doesn't even ask the question, it presumes. We should at least ask the question. Does additional disclosure provide any sort of burden? The Supreme Court has said so time and time again, even in Citizens United. Which brings me to what those burdens are. There's really two. First is the actual merits of the proposal. Recall that in Citizens United, the government argued that it could ban the movie. And it could ban speech. Really, one of the two central provisions of McCain-Feingold was the so-called electioneering ban, which banned corporations and unions from referencing federal candidates within certain time periods before an election, regardless of whether those ads were campaign-related, unambiguously or implicitly, or whatever standard one may use. It did not have to have an electoral nexus to be banned. The government argued it could ban it because of this, what's been called the PAC option. The argument was that a corporation or union could form a PAC, so its speech rights were not affected. The Supreme Court had none of this when it reached the issue in an as-applied challenge, which was Citizens United. So the PAC option, the Supreme Court has said, does not work. The proposal that is on the table proposes what I call a pseudo-PAC. If you maintain a separate fund, well, then you can continue to do your electioneering communications. But if you do not maintain this pseudo-PAC, you then have to disclose all sorts of things, including certain shareholders. So the commission, at least some, seems to think that they can launch a rulemaking based on some unspecified jurisdiction over disclosure of shareholders. I don't think we have quite that much power. Second burden is the instability in the law that launching this kind of aggressive rulemaking brings. To those who say this is just a notice of possible rulemaking and that this doesn't prejudge anything and it leaves options on the table, I say that this causes a sort of harm with which I cannot partake. Small business, big business, the distinction has blurred over the years. In the global marketplace, it's not so much how big or small you are domestically, it's how you relate to the rest of the world. The FEC has developed over time a rather settled area of law in this area. It's through advisory opinions, but really it is a fact-based inquiry when it comes to who's on what board of directors, and if you have a U.S. Subsidiary of a foreign-owned parent, and how the commission deals with that is well documented. Very real people have made very real decisions based upon that settled area of the law. They've made decisions on who's on what board. Corporations have spent all sorts of money on corporate compliance. They have structured themselves accordingly to be able to participate in politics. Just merely the threat of changing that rule will impact business negatively, and in our current environment, that is something that I am very hesitant to do. Perhaps in a different time, in a different place, such an effort could be entertained. But today is not today. It's a well settled area of the law, and with this, I'm talking about the foreign nationals. People have made very real decisions to comply with that law, and threatening to change it causes a harm and a burden that I don't think is contemplated by those offering that sort of approach. The second burden is on those who are expected to comment. We assume that people read the Federal Register and somehow they know federal agencies are doing things, but the reality is that's not the case. Unlike Congress, who is accountable to the voters and actually represents real people, we do not. Certainly we are accountable to the people, but unlike elected officials, whose constituents can speak their mind when their elected representative strays too far from their values and priorities by voting, by exercising the right to vote. No one votes us out of office. Certainly, there are indirect accountability as agency heads. There's various rules as to that, but the reality is, this is the sort of policy judgment that Congress needs to launch. If they do, then we can certainly act. But we cannot expect businesses and perhaps unions, although I'm not entirely clear that this has any impact on unions. We cannot expect businesses to realize the ramifications and endure the burden of hiring lawyers and coming here and explaining to the commission why this is a potentially bad idea. But perhaps that's how the administrative state is set up. After all, it does shift the burden to those who might be regulated in a rulemaking to explain to the agency why some of its proposals are wrong. For example, with respect to the section that purports to concern foreign nationals, but I think is more accurately called corporate regulation, it draws lines on how many people are on boards, bright lines, which I applaud, but on the other hand, without any sort of, that I can tell, analysis or data. Perhaps there was such data and analysis done on Capitol Hill. If that's the case, then that could form the basis for legislation, but I don't think we can export that from that context and bring it over here to the regulatory context. Finally, I have trouble supporting a rulemaking at this juncture on theories that could not pass Congress because of the way this rulemaking is being handled. I think some have found a newfound religion of this kind of disclosure. Not all. I agree with Commissioner Weintraub. She has spent many years in this area and does have a pedigree and street cred on the issue of disclosure. But there is certainly disclosure mania on the editorial pages and certain academic circles. And it's interesting that this kind of disclosure seems to have come about in a heated election cycle where accusations of secret money and the bogeyman of foreign nationals was brandished about. The proposal claims that this is the quote-unquote first time that the foreign national ban may operate regarding political activities paid for by U.S. subsidiaries of foreign parents. I don't think that's the case, because these folks could have PACs. They've had PACs for years, and what is a PAC? It's a separate fund. But PACs are administered by corporate funds, and these PACs can use soft money to pay for its overhead and its fundraising. One of the great, what I call dirty secrets of McCain-Feingold, was it did not ban soft money entirely in federal elections. It only banned it partially. It allowed corporations to continue to use soft money to pay for even express advocacy, advocating the election or defeat of federal candidates, fully coordinated with those candidates. And U.S. subs of foreign parents, assuming that it met the various precedence of the FEC and was deemed actually a U.S. company for purposes of its PAC rules, could do just that. So the notion that this is brand new is, I think, a fallacy. This has been an issue that's been there for years. The FEC has addressed it for years, and it will continue to address it for years. Everyone agrees that foreign nationals are banned from participating in U.S. elections. That's the current law. McCain-Feingold strengthened that law. The commission implemented regulations giving life to that law. And no one disputes that foreign nationals cannot participate in elections because, after all, a jurisdiction defines itself by who gets to vote in its elections and who gets to participate in its politics. It's rather fundamental of a democracy that people who are not part of the democracy do not get to participate in who runs the democracy. We have tried to work with everyone here to fashion a proposal that would include perhaps some modifications to current disclosure rules, or at least propose them and the like. The proposal I do support, which asks the question, should we remove regs from the books, also includes some things that I personally disagree with, but in an interest of trying to find common ground, me and my colleagues agreed that, sure, we'll put things in that, to me, don't make a lot of sense. For example, there's an entire section that tries to differentiate between speech and conduct, citing, the O'Brien case, which was the case that concerned burning draft cards. Supreme Court in that case held that that was conduct. It could be banned. It was not speech, although there was incidental speech, because the draft card actually belongs to the U.S. government. As we know, in Texas v. Johnson, you can burn a flag, but you cannot burn my flag. You can burn only your flag. You cannot burn the draft card that belongs to the U.S. government, but probably could burn a photocopy thereof. So, quite sensibly, the Supreme Court has differentiated between conduct and speech. But Buckley made clear that is not applicable in political speech. On the contrary, the conduct is intertwined to the speech to the degree that it becomes one and the same. To explain this concept in more plain English, the focus is on activities which are conduct, which allow for political activity. For example, driving volunteers to go door to door, knock on doors, and say vote for a certain candidate. The question being asked is the conduct of driving to someone's door to drop someone off, to knock on the door, is that conduct that can still be banned because Citizens United only reached independent expenditures in the form of television ads? Kind of a stretch, because once one disconnects the actual going to the door to knock on the door and the political speech at the door, it seems like the government is just regulating what would then be deemed private conduct. Makes no sense to me, but I think it's worth seeking comment, because I'm always interested to get comment on the various lines the court has drawn. But it seems that the less electoral the conduct is, the more likely it is the government can regulate it. That makes no sense to me, but in the spirit of trying to find middle ground, certainly willing to put it into the proposed rulemaking. I conclude with returning to the burden that simply launching a rule absent any new legislation from Congress could impose. And I'd like to bring to folks' attention some comments offered by former chair of the FEC, Michael Toner. He testified in front of the House Administration Committee some time ago on the Disclose Act. First, he makes clear that FECA currently bans foreign nationals, including foreign corporations, from directly or indirectly making contributions or expenditures in connection with U.S. elections, including independent expenditures and electioneering communications. He goes through in great detail the various regulations currently on the books and being enforced by the FEC to ensure that foreign nationals do not participate in federal elections. He then turns to the the burden. And he says, and I'd like to read verbatim because I certainly cannot say it better than former Chair Toner. Notwithstanding these stringent restrictions on foreign national involvement in American elections, and despite no evidence of abuses in this area in recent years, the Disclose Act and this reg, my editorial comment, would extend the existing prohibitions on foreign national contributions and expenditures. Here, it's just the spending to U.S. corporations associated with foreign nationals. And he lists some circumstances in the Disclose Act, some of which are included in the current rule. He makes much of the fact that there would be additional disclosure, including shareholders. He also states, quote, the practical effect of these provisions, if they were to become law, would be to prohibit many American companies from making any contributions or expenditures in connection with U.S. elections, from making any independent expenditures or electioneering communications, and even for operating a corporate political action committee funded by personal contributions from company employees who are American citizens and who wish to support the company's PAC. The biggest targets of this legislation, and I would suggest this proposed rulemaking, are longstanding American subsidiaries of foreign parent corporations, companies that employ tens of thousands of Americans, have operations across the country, have significant U.S. earnings, and who may wish to use contributions or expenditures in connection with U.S. elections to operate a company PAC. Recall that how the FEC defines foreign national governs all elections. It's not just a federal issue. We actually control state law because we preempted on the issue. Former Chair Turner goes through a number of examples and business leaders explaining in detail how this could hurt job growth, job creation, hurt that sort of thing, and cause uncertainty in the law. I commend anyone who wants a more full to the extent it's possible, a more full description of where I am on this issue to review Chairman Toner's comments, because I certainly endorse them. Finally, I'd like to add on the disclosure front, to be clear, the Supreme Court did uphold the electioneering communication disclosure of McCain-Feingold. That disclosure requires corporations and unions to file reports with the FEC when they reference federal candidates within certain clear time periods, 30 days before a primary, 60 days before a general. And that's all it did. Courts do not expand the reach of statutes simply because they uphold them. They only agree that the basis offered by the government is sufficient under the proper level of scrutiny. That's all the court did. It is not a mandate for additional burdensome disclosure. Perhaps if Congress sees some daylight, they may choose to act. They may not choose to act. They tried to act. It didn't pass. I would suggest the voters spoke on Election Day, and we're not empowered to nullify that verdict, nor are we allowed to nullify what the court has actually said. Court and Citizens United also talked about the burdens of disclosure, was part of why the PAC option did not work, and the cost associated with such burden. So to be clear, corporations and unions do have to disclose. There is disclosure. There's just not as much disclosure as some people would like. Some would take from the conversations that we've heard today that we are proposing repealing disclosure. We are not doing any such thing. It's on the books and it's being enforced, and there's regulations, and there are reports being filed. Now, as a percentage matter, some have said that it's not as high a percentage as in past cycles, but, well, there's more speech. The Supreme Court just allowed a whole new group of folks to speak that prior to that had been banned, so there probably will be more reports. I think after more election cycles come and go, we may have a clearer picture as to what may need to be done. To the extent we have ideas, we can put those in our legislative recommendations. I may actually support some. Having reviewed a number of MERS, there's always probably room for improvement somewhere, but that's a different discussion than launching a rule where we shift the burden to private people to know, to comment, and try to articulate why this is a bad idea. For me, it's too much of a burden, and given the overtones on the Hill, I feel that's been imported here to the FEC, which is unfortunate. Because I think we're better than that, but to me it seems that this is along the lines of an administrative power grab designed to score cheap political points at the expense of the liberties guaranteed by the Supreme Court. So I cannot support the proposed rulemaking offered by three of my colleagues, but I am wholeheartedly willing to support the proposal offered by myself and two of my colleagues.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support Draft B, and I just want to take just a couple minutes to explain why that's the case. Draft B takes a narrower approach, but I think it's the correct approach. And I think when we kind of recap exactly what happened in Citizens United, I think that that becomes more abundantly clear. It's important to remember that the Supreme Court struck down as unconstitutional provisions in the Federal Election Campaign Act that banned corporations from making independent expenditures in electionary communications. However, at the same time, it upheld the Act's reporting and disclaimer requirements that apply to independent expenditures in electionary communications. And in the process, the Court expressly declined to address the Act's ban on foreign nationals making contributions or expenditures in connection with federal elections. So, again, Citizens United upheld the commissions. I mean, it struck down a lot of things about what we can regulate, but it specifically upheld our reporting regime, and it didn't touch the foreign national ban. So, to me, a rulemaking that is billed as implementing the Citizens United decision should focus squarely on commission rules that are directly implicated and impacted by that decision, not on rules that the court either upheld or refused to review. There still remains a great deal of confusion about what exactly corporations and labor unions can do post-Citizens United. There's some questions that have been answered, but there's a lot that hasn't. And what questions we think may have been answered clearly after talking to many who have to try to decipher what they can and can't do outside this building, they're not having as easy of a time as maybe we are. So clearing up that confusion should be the foremost priority of any rulemaking that we're going to take in the aftermath of Citizens United. That's why the Draft B focuses on Part 114 of the regulations, which deal with corporate and labor organization activities. And just kind of an additional concern is I fear that this rulemaking, if we were to continue to add the weighty issues that on top of those that are that Citizens United, that case already puts in squarely on our plate, that the more issues we add, the greater the likelihood that the rulemaking itself is going to achieve nothing in the end. It will collapse of its own weight. There's the old saying about the dog that chases two rabbits at once loses both. I think that could be applicable here if we try to pursue too many different issues that don't necessarily relate to were not directly implicated by the Citizens United decision. And I think that concern about that if we add too much, we may never get anywhere in the first place is especially acute when we consider that the additional issues that are being recommended to be added to this rulemaking aren't even part of the Citizens United decision itself. Let's take the foreign national issue for a minute. The 57-page slip opinion that was issued by the Supreme Court contained exactly one paragraph about the foreign national issue, and it addressed the foreign national issue only to the extent to say we're not going to touch it, basically saying we need not reach the question whether the government has a compelling interest in preventing foreign individuals or associations from influencing our nation's political process. Notwithstanding that, the draft A, the proposed NPRM that three of my colleagues support, nearly a quarter of the discussion in the narrative of the NPRM deals with the foreign national ban, and it's understandable. It's a very complicated and very thorny issue, and I fear that if we were to try to tag that on to this rulemaking again, when it wasn't even at the heart of the Citizens United decision, we would be in danger of having that swallow the whole rulemaking or causing it to collapse. And just on the issue of the foreign nationals, I hear my colleague Commissioner Weintraub say that she has street cred on disclosure, and I agree with that, and she's been a very vigorous advocate on that front. But the proposal that is set forth in draft A isn't just about disclosure. It could result in substantial amounts of speech that American citizens could no longer engage in. As Commissioner McGann noted, one of the impacts of one of the proposals that is being set forward is that domestic subsidiaries of foreign parent corporations could be banned from establishing and administering separate segregated funds, something that has been part of the regulatory structure that this agency has created for decades, for probably 30 years. And those rules allow American citizens to make decisions about using their money and allowing money that domestically generated profits to pay for the establishment of these and the administration of these agencies, and these would no longer, under at least one proposal, no longer allow these to be established and administered, which is, again, that's more than disclosure. That's actually limiting options for American citizens to engage in speech. So, again, the Supreme Court expressly refused to address the foreign national ban. I'm not saying that this isn't an important issue. Obviously, it is. That's the reason why Congress took it up. But should we adopt the draft NPRM supported by my colleagues, I fear that that could end up just that the whole rulemaking could buckle as a result. I don't think that the approach, draft B, that I support and that two of my colleagues support, is ignoring the Supreme Court's decision about disclosure. Again, the Supreme Court upheld our disclosure regime. I don't think maintaining the status quo is in any way ignoring what the court said about the importance of disclosure. Again, that was one of the about the only element of our of the law that we regulate that it upheld. And just turning to the issue for a moment about Congress and what they've and their actions in this area, that's an enormously important factor for us to consider as we determine what the scope of our rulemaking should be, to consider what Congress has done, or to more accurately say what Congress has failed to do in this area. As we know and has been mentioned, in response to the Citizens United decision, some in Congress sought to pass the Disclose Act, which was designed to significantly expand disclosure requirements and also to substantially broaden the prohibition on foreign nationals making contributions or expenditures in connection with federal elections. But notwithstanding the fact that there were numerous congressional hearings, that there were lengthy floor debates in both the House and the Senate, Congress has not thus far passed the Disclose Act. Now, I think that it failed. There were two cloture votes that were brought in the Senate that both failed. Now, what are we to make of that? I think we can't ignore the significance of Congress not passing the Disclose Act. As others have mentioned, I mean, it's kind of eighth grade civics class, first day, that Congress enacts the laws and executive branch agencies implement and administer and enforce. And I don't think, I fear that this agency picking up those elements and trying to implement through regulation what wasn't able to be achieved through the legislative process, I think that raises some very serious and grave concerns. I think that the political process, Congress has taken this issue up, and I think we need to respect that. And again, it wasn't just one random member in Congress who submitted a bill and that we're all going to say we can't act. This was a very serious and very coordinated and an energetic effort to pass, and it garnered substantial support, but Congress wasn't able to, it did not enact the Disclose Act, and we can't ignore that. And that, I think, is a further reason why I think that the scope of this rulemaking should be more narrow in its focus. So those are a few of the reasons why I support Draft B. I hope that that at some point we can get something out, because I think that there are a lot of questions that still remain post Citizens United regarding our regulations in Part 114 that do need to be answered in order for people to know how to more what they can and can't do and how they report what it is they can do. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Hunter.
Yes, thank you. I too am prepared to support Draft B of the NPRM. I was thinking back today about the numerous discussions that we had in the Regulations Committee over this subject over the past almost year, and all the fun that we had. Yes, we did agree back in the day to launch a rulemaking on, we called it specifically, Citizens United Number 1, implying that there'd be a number 2, maybe even a number 3. The problem was, apparently, we didn't agree on what would be in Citizens United Number 1. And that's been borne out over many months of hard-fought negotiations. I think it's worthy to point out that the first approximately 66 pages of Draft A are very similar to the draft that we're proposing today, and that is because, as Commissioner Weintraub points out, we went back and forth, we discussed these issues, we were willing to, as Commissioner McGann mentioned, we were willing to put a lot of ideas that we think are on very dubious legal grounds, but we were willing to put them in there as alternative B all throughout our document, the NPRM draft B, in order to hear what the public thought about these, what we believe to be ideas that are based on dubious legal foundation. We were willing to do that. There was even a point in time where we were willing to consider putting portions of the disclosure in the rulemaking. But I suppose you could say we came to our senses, and for reasons that we've discussed here today, including that we're not interested in putting in provisions that Congress has rejected not once but twice after a full and robust debate, and two, as has been pointed out, the Supreme Court upheld the disclosure provisions, did not suggest in any way that the FEC had any authority to go back and amend the rules, as has been discussed. And the third part, which Commissioner Peterson just mentioned, I'd like to talk about just for a minute, is I firmly believe that if we were to add the disclosure provisions and the foreign national provision into this rulemaking, we would, I think, be holding the rest of the NPRM hostage. And the reason I say that is I give Commissioner Weintraub credit for being consistent and insistent that she had to have disclosure and foreign national in this NPRM. She has said that from day one. I have tried to talk her out of it from day one. But she has never wavered from that position in any way, shape, or form. And so my sort of practical, I think, legitimate fear is that we launch this rulemaking, which I do think improperly shifts the burden to the public to have to defend something that we don't even have the authority to do. But that aside, we launch a rulemaking, and I believe there's evidence that some of our colleagues will be, again, consistent and insistent on requiring some form of that disclosure or foreign nationals to be in the final rule. So I think we've run a really serious risk of never coming up with anything on the back end, and I think that's unfortunate, but that's another sort of more practical reason from my perspective for not wanting to put these matters in the NPRM. Commissioner Walther suggested that we should get together and talk about this, and maybe within 30 days we could come up with something. I'm always willing to talk. As some of my colleagues know, I'm calling them in the middle of the night, emailing. I'm happy to talk at any point in the ladies' room, anywhere else.
I wish you wouldn't do that.
I know. Sometimes they run away from me. But I'm happy to talk about it at any point. But I think we should start thinking about what should happen if we're not able to pass to adopt an NPRM in the near future. And maybe that means, you know, I see former Chairman Lenhardt in the audience, and Commissioner McGann reminded me last night of a press release that he issued when he was here, you know, telling the public, in light of the HALOGA passing Congress, to do whatever was reasonable, something along those lines, to comply with the HALOGA Act before the commission was able to come up with regulations. So maybe something along those lines would be something my colleagues would be willing to do, put out a press release saying, you know, that the public should do what they believe is appropriate in light of the Supreme Court's decision until we're able to come up with a rule. Another idea is maybe we ask the staff, our capable staff who deal with the public day in and day out in the Information Division, the RAD Division, and even in OGC, to come forward and talk to us about what the ramifications would be of having no rulemaking whatsoever. I think that's not the best way forward for our helpful guides and seminars and that sort of thing. I think the public needs guidance at a minimum on the first 66 pages that we could all agree on and vote on right now. So I think these are real concerns that we need to, you know, not just come up here and talk about how we're not able to move forward, but happy to talk about how to move forward going forward, and look forward to continuing the quest with my colleagues. Thank you.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm reminded of a scene from Fiddler on the Roof where the daughter comes to her father and says that she wants to pick her own groom, and he says, "What are you, the matchmaker, the bride, the guests all rolled into one? Next you're going to want to perform the ceremony? How can we do this?" It seems to me that Commissioner McGann wants to take off his commissioner hat, run around the table, sit down at the witness table, and provide evidence and testify on behalf of the corporate community out there about how burdensome even proposing a regulation would be. So then he gets to run around to the back of the table again and say, oh, you know what? I just persuaded myself. How about that? Now we've taken testimony from the only witness I care about, me. Oh, no, I'm sorry. We're also allowed to listen to former Chair Toner, but nobody else in the public is allowed to weigh in on the notion of whether we should consider a rule. And that's all we're talking about. I'm somewhat bemused at Commissioner Hunter already saying, well, I know what you're going to do down the road, but as former Chairman Lenhardt could tell you, often things change in the course of... In fact, I can think of rulemakings that we've worked on together where I came to very different conclusions at the end of the day based on the public comment that we get. The notion that we can't launch a rulemaking because even asking the public for input is just too burdensome for them. They can't be bothered. Oh, those corporations, they don't have lawyers. They don't have compliance staff. How are they supposed to know what this FEC is doing? They can't come in and comment. I'm just very entertained by that. And yes, it is a feature of the administrative state that we do ask the public for comment. Commissioners sitting on their own at the dais don't make up their minds and prejudge all the issues before they're even put out for comment. I appreciate my colleagues' recognition of my 20 years in the trenches on the disclosure issue, although it is somewhat undermined when I'm then accused of trying to score cheap political points, which I don't really appreciate. I have to take issue with the suggestion that the Supreme Court has upheld our reporting regime. The Supreme Court has never had our regulations in front of them, ever. What they had in front of them was a statute, which they have upheld twice. Now, interestingly enough, for those who are concerned about the role of unelected bureaucrats, to use your term, the statute that Congress has enacted, I mean, the notion that we can't, I think Commissioner Hunter said at one point that the Supreme Court never said we have authority to amend our rules on disclosure. We don't have authority to amend our rules on disclosure. The Federal Election Campaign Act that we administer and enforce is full of disclosure provisions. Of course we have the authority to issue regulations on disclosure on anything that's in this book. Among the provisions in this book, by the way, is a statute that was passed by Congress on the disclosure of electioneering communications that says that the donors behind the electioneering communications are supposed to be disclosed unless the communications are funded from a segregated bank account. And what we know from a very able report put out by Public Citizen just, I think, this week, analyzing 1 year after Citizens United, is that corporate spending has, let me quote them directly, corporate expenditure soared while disclosure of donors plummeted. And I have to take some of the responsibility of that because I was part of a rulemaking that some people have construed in a way that I did not intend in a very narrow way. But beyond even what the rule says on its face, three commissioners of this agency have taken it upon themselves to interpret that rule in such a way as to eviscerate any requirement for donors to be disclosed, because that is the consequence of your statement of reasons in the Freedoms Watch enforcement matter. And for three unelected bureaucrats, to use your term, to try and supersede the judgment of Congress on a statute that has been upheld by eight justices of the Supreme Court, that is what I think is inappropriate. And that, I think, is what we really have to take a look at. And specifically, we have to take a look at the regulation that this commission issued several years ago, which we now have data on how it is being interpreted in the regulated community and how it's being used. And I, for one, know that it's not being interpreted the way I intended it. And I think it really cries out for a relook. And we obviously have authority to do that. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had authority to issue the regulation in the first place. On the subject of foreign nationals, I will concede that the section is complicated and, you know, sort of takes a,
a fresh look at a lot of issues, but it is not true that these issues have already been vetted through the Commission for many, many years. What the Commission has looked at for many, many years are issues arising for U.S. citizens who work for subsidiaries of foreign corporations and whether they can form a PAC that will use their own money, the money of U.S. citizens, to make political contributions. That is a very different issue than the one that is currently before us, which is what happens when corporate money starts to be used and at what point does the corporate money, we all know that money is fungible, of subsidiaries, could that be deemed to be the money of the foreign parent? And I don't know the answer to that. And I am not prejudging any of those issues, but I do think that the time is very ripe for us to take a look at it. I am also amused by the notion that we need to narrow our focus because, as Commissioner Hunter will recall, much of the debate that we had over the course of the last year pertained to provisions that are no longer in either draft. I mean, you guys wanted to look at the Fair Labor Standards Act, for heaven's sakes, and put that in this rulemaking, and that's where I said, are you kidding? What's that got to do with Citizens United? So I'm really thrilled to see that at least that issue has been laid on the table for the time being. You know, we went through this process, and from the very first outline that was presented to us by the staff, when we had originally thought about doing it in two stages, but the very first outline that we received from staff included disclosure in the first stage. There was never a document here that was produced by staff or by us, maybe there was one produced by you alone, that did not have disclosure in it. And as you have acknowledged, and I appreciate that, I said at that very first regs meeting and in every single conversation we have had since then that I could not consider moving forward on only the issues that you consider important and not on the issues that I consider important, paramount among them being disclosure. Are we willing to compromise by doing everything that you want to do and not what we want to do by addressing the regulations that you think are important and not the ones that we think are important? No, I don't consider that a very good compromise, and I am not prepared to do that. I mean, if you want ideas for how to move forward at this point, if we cannot agree on either of these documents, I think, you know, obviously we could get endless petitions for rulemaking from people out there who might want to make suggestions to us, or we could affirmatively solicit people's suggestions on what ought to be included in a rulemaking. This actually was suggested by one of my colleagues at a very early point last year that we should put out a notice, an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, to solicit comment from the public on what topics ought to be included in our Citizens United rulemaking. And I have to admit, I initially poo-pooed the idea. I thought, we will look so foolish if we go out there and say we can't figure out what the issues are in this case. But perhaps we can't. So perhaps that would be a step to take to put it out there and ask people, hey, public, and I hate to further burden people in the public to actually participate in the process of government, but hey, we could ask for some suggestions on, and I bet we would get some, probably from a lot of people we know well, and probably from some people that don't comment all the time on what they think should and should not be included in a rulemaking to address this decision. But as I will end where I started, that I cannot, unless I got unanimous comment from the public saying, no, don't do disclosure, no need to do that, I do not envision a way that I could support a rulemaking document that did not include disclosure. I know it was proposed at an early point that we could do that in a later stage, maybe, but given that it's taken us a year and we still don't even have an NPRM out, I mean, in the old days, we'd get a Supreme Court opinion and we'd have an NPRM out in a couple of months and the whole rulemaking wrapped up in 6 to 8 months, but we can't seem to function that way anymore. So I seem to recall my suggestion to doing it in two stages and putting disclosure in the second stage was that, you know, we'd be lucky to get it done by 2012. And at this rate, I think that might have been an optimistic prediction. All right, I'll stop there.
From my perspective, I just want to, and then I'll go to Vice Chair Hunter. I'll be supporting draft A because I believe we must ensure at least that our reporting requirements are capable of providing meaningful disclosure as provided for by the Act, given this newly permissible corporate activity. And I hear what my colleagues are saying about the fact that the Disclose Act failed twice, but I don't think there's any question that the fact that Congress has failed to tie our hands to any one proposal through legislation is hardly an argument that we are incapable, consistent with existing statutory authority, of acting on our own. And that's what is included with respect to disclosure in Draft A. For example, as Commissioner Weintraub just mentioned, the Commission adopted a relatively narrow rule with respect to EC reporting, limiting those to the purpose of made for the purpose of furthering ECs. The statute does not include such a limiting factor, and there's no reason the Commission shouldn't reconsider whether retaining that limit makes sense after Citizens United. And given the disagreement amongst the commissioners, as we articulated in Freedom's Watch, and what we said in our statement in that case was that if there's an impediment to achieving appropriate disclosure consistent with the statutory mandate, we should revisit these rules, and that's what we're attempting to do in Draft A. Just as a personal note, maybe I take more offense than perhaps Commissioner Weintraub, because her record was affirmed. I'm uncomfortable, and I think it's inappropriate for allegations to be made about people's motivations for why they're doing any particular thing. I think, you know, frankly, if someone wants to examine my record with respect to disclosure, feel free, but I'm not sure that that's really fruitful as part of this discussion in terms of what issues should be on the table for this rulemaking. As I said, I think this the proposals in A certainly have statutory grounding in terms of requiring or asking about whether additional disclosure should be required, particularly in the EC sense and also in the IE regime. One of the proposals is to ask about whether there should be any additional, whether there's additional good to be gained in terms of disclosure with some new requirements. And again, These are questions set out for the public to give us their comments on. That is part of the process that we must go through, not only because the APA requires it, but because that is the way to most faithfully execute what we are supposed to be here to do, which is uphold the statute as written by Congress. I'm not suggesting that we should that this agency can do something that Congress must. But just because Congress made an effort to do something doesn't mean we don't have existing authority under the statute as currently written. Vice Chair Hunter, I believe you do reign. Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. Being referred to as both commissioner and a witness in the same meeting reminded me of something I was taught when I started out as a younger lawyer back when I used to actually try cases in court. And the fellow I worked for taught me that when you do a direct and you turn it over to cross and you have a chance to redirect, sometimes the most powerful thing to do is not ask any questions or perhaps simply ask one question. What I can say is we can move a proposed rulemaking out the door today. There's no reason to keep unconstitutional regulations on the books. There is so much agreement between the six commissioners that I don't see a good reason to vote against that approach. Other than that, I have no further questions. You have made my case for me.
Commissioner Walther.
Just a couple of comments. I think in the conversation, some of it's gotten lost about where we could go in view of Citizens United. For example, with corporations and the subsidiaries now, the life is different now. When we had, when everyone, all corporations were prohibited from spending their treasury funds, then that was an easy thing for us to see. Now, all corporations are permitted to use their treasury funds except for foreign corporations. In the past, with respect to foreign corporations, we had a process to insulate the influence to a reasonable degree, and not probably as much as I would like to see, but the only way that that could happen for a subsidiary was to have an SSF and to run it by citizens with their money, and they get the ones, they're the ones who decide, I'd like to think always, but I don't think de facto it works that way, free of foreign influence. Now the subsidiaries can spend unlimited amounts of the subsidiaries' money. This is the money that's generated, and basically the corporation is owned directly by a foreign corporation, or to a substantial degree, or to a controlling degree. I think if we neglect that fact, that now foreign corporations can, through their subsidiaries, spend unlimited amounts of money, do we not ask any questions about where the money comes from? Do we not ask who's behind it? Do we not ask what decision makers there are? Do we not try and give the public enough information to find out just how much money is coming from the foreign corporation and how much of it is under the control of foreign nationals? Unless we can ask those questions, I think there's a floodgate that's there that's never been really anticipated before, a potential for that. And I think, to go back on a couple of comments about the burden aspect of having a rulemaking when we ask these questions, what we're basically talking about are some subjects like disclosure, foreign national. Now, are we really going to say that in the era of free speech that we're going to deny people the right to participate? That's really all it amounts to. We can ask the questions. If it's a burden, they don't have to, but at least they have the option. They can actually participate in the democratic process by talking to us about their views. There's not been a procedure like that. In Congress, they've had hearings, but not everybody gets the opportunity to participate like we do in a case like this. So what benefit do we get? What democratic principle is advanced? What free speech is advanced, which we're really talking about, by saying, we're not going to even let you talk to us about it? And I think that's my concern. I think when in doubt, we should put our questions in. I think they're all in there in good faith on both sides, much as we disagree sometimes. And I think we ought to be mindful of that and let the public tell us what they think.
Is there any further discussion? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond to a few things that have been said. One, with respect to the Freedoms Watch statement that me and a couple of my colleagues put out a few months ago, I mean, I guess I should be flattered that it had that had much of a far-reaching impact. I doubt that it is to that extent, and I think it should be noted that the standard that we applied in that case just merely mirrored the independent expenditure. Standard for determining when contributors need to be disclosed on IE reports. That's been on the books for over 30 years. So we weren't in reinventing the wheel. We just made it consistent with what's already been on the books. And I I'd like to believe that what we said had that big of an impact, but somehow I doubt that it was quite that weighty. Secondly, I think some of what's been said kind of rewrites the history of the negotiation regarding the rulemaking that we have before us. Yes, we did go back and forth, and there are things that we wanted put in, but it hasn't been the case that all along that I and the vice chair and Commissioner McGann were saying we want our stuff and you can't have any of yours. The drafts that we, as Caroline said, maybe we finally got scared straight once we saw how far we were going down the path. I mean, my original hope was last year after the decision was to have a streamlined rulemaking right out of the gates that answered the questions that I thought could be fairly non-controversial. And then things were added to that. And then once one person, you know, adds something outside the scope, then everybody else is going to want to too. And here we are now. But it wasn't the case that we didn't even want questions asked. In fact, in many cases, it was quite the opposite. There were things that I and some of my colleagues wanted in there, and it was told to us that the mere inclusion of those could send the wrong signal. Just asking the question could be dangerous. So now that I hear that asking questions, no obligations, that's not always what I've heard throughout this whole process, and I do think that in rulemakings that we there are, we're not always going to put in things that we like. In the document, as Commissioner McGann alluded to, there are things in draft B that we aren't particularly thrilled with, but they were within the scope, I think, of the issues that were addressed by the decision. And for that reason, we agreed to put those in. Again, I don't know where this is going to take us from here. I hope we can get something out. I think we do need to get something out. I think that there are a number of issues. I think that the decision, that the more narrow approach is not a ministerial exercise in answering questions to which everyone already knows the answers. There are many questions regarding, you know, organizations that coordinate with candidates on making appearances before a restricted class. What if they subsequently make or want to make express advocacy communications? Will those be considered illegal coordinated communications? That's an issue that's directly at issue, that's, you know, implicated by the NPRM that I support, and there's clearly no answer to that. I have my opinions, but I doubt that there are a lot of people in the regulated community that feel that they have a rock solid answer on that. Whether restrictions on corporations and labor unions using express advocacy with respect to their voter guides and get out the vote and voter registration activities. Is it obvious that there are answers to those questions out there in the regulated community? I doubt it. Whether independent corporate speech urging the, you know, viewers or readers to contribute to federal candidates, whether those may be restricted under the commission's facilitation regs. That's a question that is brought up in ours. There are a lot. I think that the more narrow approach already is biting off a tremendous amount, and but it is addressing things that again that were directly, I think, implicated by the decision. And I think that going beyond that, here we are a year later. I think going beyond that scope has a great deal to do with why we haven't been able to move forward up to this point. Thanks.
Any further comments? Do we have any motions? Commissioner Walther, did you?
No, they were kind of in this anticipation of the expected motion. We probably ought to go ahead and vote and talk, have a few comments after that, perhaps. I don't know.
Commissioner Weintraub?
I was going to make a motion. I did want to preface it by saying that I want to make sure I move the right document here. All right, so one of them, okay, no, I've got it. I move, Madam Chair, adoption of agenda document number 11-02, which is also been referred to as draft A, and it says so parenthetically in the subject line. Sometimes gets confusing where there's an A in the bottom but not on the top. I want to say with respect to that motion that I believe that draft A is firmly grounded in this statute that is already on the books. We did, in preparing our draft, look at ideas that had been proposed by other people around town, because we would have been foolish not to take advantage of all the good thinking of other smart people, or to assume that only the people who work in this building, that we have a monopoly on all the good ideas. However, as I said at the beginning, and I'll say it again, we are happy to entertain any other ideas on the topics of disclosure or foreign national. In fact, I think there's an alternative in the foreign national section that was drafted by our Republican colleagues, and we left it in. And we're happy to consider any other ideas. We obviously did not import any sections of a legislative proposal that were beyond our statutory authority. I mean, I could run through a long gamut of differences between the Disclose Act and our proposal. That would probably be very boring for people, but I just want to reiterate that everything in this document is firmly grounded in existing statutory law. And that's why I feel very comfortable moving the adoption of Agenda Document 11-02.
The question for the Commission is adoption of Agenda Document 11-02. Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed say no.
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 The motion fails. Commissioner Walther, Commissioner Weintraub, and myself voting in favor. Commissioner Peterson, Commissioner McGann, and Vice Chair Hunter voting against. Are there any other motions? Vice Chair Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move adoption of agenda document number 11-02-A, which is essentially the first 66 pages of the agenda document that was just defeated. Thank you.
The question for the Commission is approval of agenda document 1102A. Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
No. The motion fails by a vote of 3-3. Commissioner Peterson, McGann, and Vice Chair Hunter in favor, Commissioner Walter, Commissioner Weintraub, and myself in opposition. As I think has been noted here at the table, and I think is very good news, is that we want to continue working towards how to provide the public with additional guidance, either through an NPRM that perhaps we can find some common agreement on, or there are obviously other options. So I don't think that anyone should walk away from this meeting with the understanding that this is the last you'll hear from the Federal Election Commission on this issue. I hope it will be sooner rather than later. I hear what Commissioner Walther is saying, that this has taken too long. There has been a lot of effort on it, and one of the reasons, again, I wanted to put on the agenda today is because even though we weren't able to reach some consensus, there has been a lot of, as you will see from the inch of blue paper that everyone has, there has been a lot of thought that has gone into this. Obviously, we still have some disagreements about what the final document may look like, but it is my hope that we can continue to move forward on that. The Commission has no further business on its agenda, but I have a question for Mr. Palmer. Are there any management and administrative matters that we need to attend to?
Madam Chair, there are none.
That will adjourn our meeting for today. Thank you.
And I want to wish Commissioner Hunter's daughter happy birthday tomorrow.